Welcome to the August podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. In this podcast, Dr. John Jayne Jr. of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville speaks with Dr. John Persing of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. They discuss the article by Dr. Persing and colleagues titled Combined Metopic and Sagittal Craniosynostosis: Is It Worse Than Sagittal Synostosis Alone? The article appears in this month's issue.
Welcome to the August issue podcast for the Neurosurgical Focus issue on craniofacial deformity. This is John Jayne Jr. speaking with John Persing. Dr. Persing is the section chief of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Yale Medical School and has written an article entitled Combined Metopic and Sagittal Craniosynostosis: Is It Worse Than Sagittal Synostosis Alone? Dr. Persing, welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Persing, I wanted to start off by talking about the article and then try to find out from you what you feel that the clinical applications of your findings were. In thinking about the conclusions of the article, which essentially, to review for the listeners, were that in children who have combined metopic and sagittal craniosynostosis, as well as children with sagittal synostosis alone, what is found is that there is a decrease in the overall intracranial volume and the brain tissue volume, and an overall increase in the CSF space and ventricular volumes. Would you say that that is an accurate summary of the findings of the paper?
Yes, I think there are little caveats that can be added, meaning that it's not a uniform statement that we are achieving statistical significance in each one of these questions. There are more trends, and we think that's still valid to discuss because we think these are correlates of brain dysfunction, which in children with craniosynostosis, we're not seeing gross hemiplegia or something like that. We're seeing more subtle neurological problems, and as a result, we expect the morphological changes to be relatively limited.
And those findings and those changes in the brain tissue volume and the intracranial volume seem to become more prominent at a specific cutoff of about 4.5 months. Can you speculate as to why that might be?
I can't give you any definitive answer. What I can say is that we were limited in time to 9 months when we did this study. And the thinking there is that the metopic suture usually fuses by 9 months of age. So we wanted a point in time where the suture was partially open and then a point where it is normally fused. If I could just reiterate this, the metopic suture, again, fuses at 9 months of age. We wanted to have the question answered, is sagittal metopic combined worse than sagittal alone? And it seemed only to make sense that we'd be asking when the metopic normally fuses physiologically. So at 9 months, it's normally fused. So looking at it afterward would not have as much relevance as looking at it during the time period where it is supposed to be open, that is, in the first 9 months of life. So that's a long way to get back to your question of why at 4.5 months there might be a change. I think it's a continuum. What we're really seeing is that as things move along from birth, or actually probably from earlier fetal development to the time it's supposed to be fused normally, that is 9 months after birth, that you're getting changes occurring in an additive fashion. And when we start off at birth, perhaps with all the ability to compensate throughout the skull, the volumes are not going to be as affected as later on in life. We did an earlier study where we looked at sagittal alone patients and looked at their intracranial volume over the course of time. And initially, the intracranial volumes were normal. But as you get older, that is after a year of age and then ultimately after about 3 years of age, we got a progressive enlargement of the intracranial volume in subarachnoid space. So, and this was unfortunately accompanied by a reduction in brain volume. And we wanted to know, well, with this study, whether the metopic suture added on to sagittal synostosis alone its premature closure would make this more of an acute process. So I don't think there's anything magic about 4.5 months. I think it's more of a continuum, and there are additive factors that probably other sutures fusing, the rate of brain growth, and perhaps just the thickness of the bone adding to the findings we had in this study.
But the findings, at the very least, seem to support the concept that doing earlier surgery is likely better for the growing brain. And if you agree with that concept, has this study prompted you to consider doing earlier repairs than your standard time?
Yes, that was the basic message. If we had a combined fusion of the sagittal and metopic, the question was, does that create a significantly reduced intracranial volume relative to what the brain needs to grow appropriately? And when you compare that to sagittal alone, metopic and sagittal were pretty much the same. They both resulted in a reduced intracranial volume, but only in a very small subgroup. There were females that were older than 5.5 months were the ones that had a intracranial volume which is actually smaller than the sagittal alone. So in other words, if the cup is half full, you'd say, well, then it does show that the sagittal metopic patients do, in fact, have a reduced intracranial volume relative to just a single suture alone. And the findings, though, are relatively soft, meaning that there is a trend. The statistical analysis showed that it was only about 0.1 in terms of p-value for significance. And it wasn't like a p.05 type of significance level. So in all the other subgroups, that is. And as a result, I think that what we found is that the sagittal metopics and the sagittal alones pretty much mirror each other in most parts. But in some selected areas, there is either an increase in the ventricular volume. That's what we found in the patients at 4.5 months of age. There was an increase in ventricular volume relative to the sagittal alone. And then the metopic sagittal together, only the female kids who were older than 4.5 months of age, were the ones that had a reduced intracranial volume relative to sagittal alone. In short, what I'd like to say is that I think the critical message here is we do have a reduced intracranial volume in both the sagittals and the sagittal metopics. It has spurred me to operating earlier in both cases because I think the concerns are evident in both. The degree of change is not as dramatic as I thought it might be with the metopic added onto a sagittal, but because they're consistent saying that this is a problem, that is, the intracranial volume is reduced in both, I think earlier the better surgery.
So that result, in a sense, surprised you that you did not find a dramatic difference in intracranial volumes between the isolated sagittal and the sagittal plus metopics.
Correct. Our initial thought was when you looked at a kid with sagittal and metopic, they actually look better. In other words, they don't have the frontal bossing.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought was that, gee, these guys are going to have significantly reduced intracranial volume. We did not find that as a consistent thing, except for that subgroup I talked about, that is the females over 4.5 months. But the explanation for that, I would say, at least a plausible thing, is that other cranial suture sites are able to compensate for the fusion with the metopic to a degree that's equal to or just about equal to having the metopic open, at least for a certain time period, after which I think they all get into trouble.
And so in your opinion at this time with the results of this study and thinking about your practice now, if you were able to see a child at 2 months of age who had sagittal craniosynostosis, what would be the time where you would say it's the right time to do a cranial vault reconstruction?
Well, I think it still should be early. There is no cutoff point, but I think earlier is better. I think you have to look at the child's general health, recommend surgery in the first 6 weeks of life. Typically, there's a nadir of hemoglobin during that time period, and the concern is that blood loss might make the operation more risky. But if you're starting to see the maternal and fetal hemoglobin situation changing enough so that they are gaining enough reserve for a surgical procedure, I would proceed as soon as that appeared to be physiologically the right thing to do. And typically the nadir is about 6 weeks of age, so usually before 3 months. And we have, in fact, with these studies, changed our approach to doing a more comprehensive procedure in the first 2 to 3 months of life as opposed to waiting between 6 to 7 months of age. I think this is kind of an important change because I think from another study that we're also doing currently, we're seeing that the earlier surgery seems to have better influence on intellectual development, regardless of what technique is being done. The question is now whether a more comprehensive cranioplasty is going to be more beneficial than perhaps a strip craniectomy, where you are relieving some of the pressure but not really modifying the cranial shape, which also may be constricting regionally. Again, I think the main message is that early surgery is better. How early is the best is still yet to be defined. At this point, I'm still erring on the side of going to as complete a procedure as I can do safely as early as possible.
And does whether you need to do an orbital rim advancement in the setting of the metopic affect the timing of your procedure? Do you find that the very thin skull and thin orbital bar is more difficult to deal with at a particularly young age, and so that you'd rather try to do that, the combined sagittal and metopic, a little bit later? Or do you find that that makes a difference in terms of your surgical planning?
It does make a difference. I typically have not been moving the orbital rims forward at the very young age. We have two different issues here. One is brain development, and the other is what the structure of the skull will look like following the operation. And obviously, the more important one is the brain development. So what I would like to see is that we operate as soon as possible to get the appropriate room for the brain to go as well as it should at as early a stage in life as we can make it without concern about what the cosmetic result is going to be. I think the orbital rims do not influence frontal lobe development as much as the low frontal bone does. I'd rather just keep the cuts as low as possible in the frontal area and try to expand out that way rather than trying to move the orbital rim forward. If it's a very severe, which has not been my experience, I've seen very few cases where the orbital rims are back so far that it indicates that we really need to move them forward at the time of the initial surgery. I would have to rethink whether the extra blood loss that's going to be set up by having the surgical procedure was going to result in enough improvement in shape and capacity for the brain to grow as well as improve the orbital rim appearance. But to be honest with you, I don't remember more than one or two cases where we've done orbital rim advancement, even though the metopic suture is fused in patients with sagittal as well.
Well, it really will be an interesting finding to see if in those kids with combined metopic and sagittal who are done early, how many of them indeed, after releasing the metopic suture and the sagittal suture, how many of them in the future need orbital rim advancements after an early surgery? And it sounds like what you're saying is your feeling is it's not going to be many.
That's my impression. We haven't studied it yet. But if you think about what's happening with, for instance, an endoscopic release of the metopic suture, many of those procedures are not accompanied by an orbital rim advancement. They tend to do pretty reasonably well. At least published reports, there are some statements that there is a reasonable amount of improvement. I haven't seen objective documentation of that yet, but I think that there is at least some evidence of a reasonable outcome, perhaps not perfect, but improvement. And if that's the case, I'm willing to come back at a later stage and either augment the surface of the skull or do, if it's a severe case, move the orbital rims forward to get the appropriate cosmetic result. Again, the focus I think we have to have in this review of this data is that the message is there is some evidence of constriction of the intracranial volume at an earlier stage, and unfortunately there's also a reduction in amount of brain mass compared to controls. What is important in this study is that we used a local control to make this, so I think it's valid. And instead of comparing it to a non-gender-specific normative index taken at another institution, there is greater room for misinterpretation. So in this case, what we wound up doing is comparing to local procedures done and local scans done with the same technique, so we feel that we can get a pretty precise analysis. And as a result, I think hopefully we'll come up with reliable data.
Well, the data also makes me worried in those patients and parents who I counsel whose child has sagittal synostosis who are not certain they actually want to have surgery at all, and how to counsel them best in terms of whether their child really needs it. And your data would at least suggest that there is a compelling argument to be made to the parents that a conservative treatment and waiting to see what happens to the cranial deformity is perhaps not the right advice to give. What is your feeling about that?
I couldn't say it better, John. I think the general idea here is that you want to have them recognize that although these learning abnormalities are subtle, there are some physical correlates now that might be connected with that. We certainly haven't shown function here. All we're doing is showing volumes and brain mass. But I think it's very telling that there are brain changes in these patients morphologically. And as a result, I think we should take it out of the realm of saying this is sort of a cosmetic procedure and think of it more as a rehabilitative procedure. That is, you're going to offer an opportunity for normal function. And we haven't yet actually published this information, but we are in the midst of trying to examine just that question. Is the completeness of the procedure influential in terms of intellectual outcome? And is the timing also influential in terms of functional outcomes? And that's something we have in the final stages of analysis right now. But our impression from that is that earlier surgery clearly has a functional benefit, and the more comprehensive procedures have some positive influence on the outcome of brain development as well. But I think probably even more important than the procedure itself is the timing of the procedure. Although both may be influential, that is the type of procedure and the timing seems to be the major factor.
I think we've got time for one more question, unless you think there are further points that we should discuss. One of the things that I'd be interested to know from you is whether you feel that a volumetric analysis should be part of our postoperative assessment of the completeness of our repair, meaning should we be showing that we've increased the intracranial volume, proving that we've done that, and if we haven't increased the intracranial volume, how should we assess that finding?
I think the short answer is I don't know the significance of this until we somehow correlate this with functional outcomes. And that will take a while to get all this information in. So I think it would be wise to have a number of centers who are going to study this problem do just that. If it means a lot of extra CAT scans and radiation exposure, I think I would have to have some pause in making that recommendation that serial CAT scans, for instance, would be necessary to measure intracranial volume. I do think it would be appropriate to have intracranial volumes measured as a piece of information that you would have available to you. And how you would use it would really depend on analysis of what that actually means functionally. It is possible that you could have a change in the brain morphology without any visible change in function. In that case, I don't think that's been an argument for continuing to do a lot of morphological studies that don't have any functional correlate. But on the other hand, if with a further study we find that the cranial shape looks good, but the intracranial volume, particularly brain mass, is reduced, and this should be ringing some alarms to tell us to try to reconstruct the skull differently, that might answer some questions that typically come up. For instance, if you see some of these kids when you have done a cranioplasty on them in infancy, they're 3 or 4 years old, and they either have a smaller shape than what you'd expect, or the parents say, you know, Johnny hits his head on the table all the time and he's having behavioral problems. Is this because his brain doesn't have enough room to grow, or should other surgeries be considered? And it's usually a gray zone to try to figure out what to do with that. If we can get some functional correlates related to perhaps cerebral blood flow or connectivity through MR, functional MR studies, all those things might provide an opportunity to answer your questions more accurately and fully.
Dr. Pershing, are there any other points that you feel that we haven't covered in this podcast regarding your article?
Again, I just would like to reiterate that the main message here is that although the intracranial volumes between metopic and sagittal are not dramatically different between each other, I think the message is still that there is a reduction in intracranial volume initially compared to controls, and that ultimately this has been associated with a reduction in brain volume. What functional correlates follow from that are still yet to be worked out. I don't think we've answered all the questions here. This is clearly a study that needs to be added to by other research teams and with as large numbers as we can get to make things accurate, to make really strong recommendations to parents. But I think we should at least bring up the idea that the surgical procedure we're doing in infancy has subtle but real neurological consequences. And review of this information will hopefully, and through multiple centers, give us more solid answers to advise families.
Dr. Pershing, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about your article that is in the upcoming issue of Neurosurgical Focus on Craniofacial Deformity. I'm sure our audience enjoyed the discussion and look forward to those future studies that you're proposing.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.